This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Keith Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
Afrodita!
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, we certainly do appreciate your support and attention. We know you have a lot of choices out there. It's cool that you choose to spend your time with us. Couldn't do it without the help of our amazing sponsors. Chemical Free Body has been a sponsor for a little while. We've had Tim James on twice now. He's doing amazing things. My God, we need to prepare our bodies for what we're dealing with. And the whole concept behind chemical-free body, no chemicals. We need it. Certified organic, plant-based, dairy-free, soy-free, GMO-free, gluten-free, damn near everything free, except for the price, but we've got a discount code for you. You can use the promo code MACRO to save money. They've got Green 85 drink. They've got weightless formula, which is pretty cool. Probiotic. You can sign up for classes. You can sign up for coaching. Tim has a podcast. It's amazing. My God, after 2020, we probably have figured out that we've got to get ourselves healthy. We can't depend on the mainstream corporate media to tell us how to do that. They won't even tell us to get exercise, eat well, and get out in the sun. So it's going to be up to us. So check out Chemical Free Body. Even if you don't buy anything, just go check out the website, surf around, see if you see anything you like. But if you do find something, use the promo code MACRO. It helps to support this show. And of course, it supports Tim as well. Well, our guest today is a special guest. Special because we met in an Acapulco. I'll get into the details of that in a minute. But he is my good friend and artist, Johnny Dollar. Johnny, how are you?
Better and better, man. It's great to be here, Charlie.
Well, it's it's good to have you. And I'm excited because I've talked about this on the podcast and on interviews I've done about my appreciation for Anarchapulco and how you go down there, you don't know what you're going to expect. You have interesting experiences, you meet fascinating people. And the way you and I met was kind of cool. I'll explain it. So they have these a la carte items you can sign up for at the conference. It's like, you know, you can sign up to go release baby sea turtles into the ocean at night on buses and things like that. You get to go to these like concerts that they have. You can sign up for, unschooling programs with David Rodriguez and guys like that who I've had on the show talk about all these interesting things. But there's also something else you can sign up for at night, and that's the psychedelics. That's the plant-based medicines. They bring in shaman that are like straight out of the jungle. I mean, these guys were so out of the jungle, I don't even think they spoke Spanish. And like little Mayan-looking guys, they're cool outfits, and they'd come in and do their ayahuasca ceremony, which I've done. And so I signed up for the Jaguar session, which is the 5-MeO DMT. And you go into this cool room and they've got, you know, candles and they've got flowers and sage burning and incense and musicians and all of these great things. And they get you in a big circle and they explain to you what you're going to experience with this. And then they partner you up. And so I got partnered next to the guy next to me, who is Johnny Dollar. And I say, what do you do? And he said, I'm an artist. And I go, well, what is that? You know, what kind of art? And he said, I do post-pop surrealism. I go, what does that even mean? He said, well, I've got art where it's Mickey Mouse holding a canister of gas with a Bitcoin logo, and he's poured gas and he's burning down the central bank. And I was like, holy shit, you and I are going to be friends for sure. Like, I got to go see this. So we did the whole session. He was my partner. I watched him while he did his session. He watched me while I did mine. We bonded. We went upstairs. We got into his art book, which I have right here. He's going to go over some of the art from it. And we've just stayed friends, you know? So here we are, and we connected again this last that was the first Anarchapulco I went to, 2019. 2020 rolls around this February. We meet up again, we connect, we have a good time. We didn't do the DMT session. I did, but I didn't do it with you. But but we had a great time. We talked about the world, we talked about art. Admittedly, I know very little about art. The only thing I know about art is that I know what I like when I see it. And when I went up to your room, you had this, you have opened this booklet, Johnny Dollar Painting 2014 to 2018, which is available for sale, I believe. Is that correct? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I looked through it and I was like, okay, this is the type of art I would do if I had an ounce of artistic ability. But since I don't, I'm just going to have to appreciate the work that you did. So tell me, how in the hell do you wind up doing, what's your journey in life that takes you to a point where you're making unbelievable Bitcoin and alternative media related artwork that's just, it's blowing up now? How did you get into this?
I kind of fell into it. You know, I was a figurative painter. I did landscapes. I painted, you know, young artist, and I like to paint naked women. And, you know, like that was a good gig. I enjoyed it. But as time went on, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, started getting into the open source community. I mean, even since, you know, college, I'd kind of been seeing what was going on in the world, stuff we talked about. I'm sure your listeners probably already know, you know, the nefarious nature of the world that isn't what we think it is. And I started seeing it, and I just tried to put it together with this language that I didn't have words for it, you know, so I had to grab these images. And, you know, a lot of it is surreal. It comes from the subconscious and dreams. And that's really, I think, where a lot of good art comes from. It's just you get an idea, that shower thought, you know, that idea, where did that come from? It just came and put it together. It's funny as the journey goes, because right now it is blowing up. And a lot of people have been contacting me because, like, a lot of the art and, you know, stuff I've been doing, things you've been writing about have all happened.
Yeah.
You know, doing it 5 years ago, even last year, it was like, oh, this is my vision of this apocalyptic dystopian future that looks like Disneyland, right. You know, and all of a sudden it's here. So it's kind of weird as an artist, because it's like the art I did, I don't really, it doesn't seem as cutting edge now. It seems more like realism, yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us in this community kind of feel like that. It's like, it was like this slow thing. Then it all happened at once.
Right.
Like we saw it coming, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
All these changes so fast. But we saw them coming like in slow motion and then bam.
As a prime example, last time you and I were hanging out, it was February of 2020. We get home, Corona kicks off, you know what I mean? Within like two or three weeks after that. So it can happen fast. And I'm like you. I mean, it's like we went from writing, talking about topics that were fictional, set in the future. And they went from being fictional to non-fictional, like overnight almost. It's bizarre. So yeah, I'm sure people are like looking at your artwork before and going, yeah, that's an interesting version of where the future could be. But now, like you said, it's not speculative. This is where we are right now. Hey, guess what? You're painting landscapes. The landscape is currently right. You know, it's right now. This landscape is, it's horrible. In fact, in some ways, I know I feel this way. You might feel the same way. It's like, I wish that I was wrong. I wish that everything I was writing about was incorrect, and because what I've been writing about is this slow march towards this Orwellian future of less rights and less freedoms and more restrictions and more authoritarianism, and I'd give anything to be absolutely out of my mind wrong on it. But unfortunately, you know, it looks like we're not. So your artwork does a great job of doing what art is supposed to do, conveying a message without the need for somebody to stand there and explain it to you. And you did that with me when you brought me up, when we went up to your room after the DMT session. You like looked through these things. You're like, tell me what you think. You wouldn't tell me what you thought about it. You wanted to get my opinion. And I would say, well, I think this, or I think that'd be cool. Yeah, interesting. I'm like, what, am I wrong? You're like, there's no right answer. There's no wrong answer. I'm just curious. So in, you know, art and writing, you know, my literature too, but specifically art, is open to interpretation. But it seems like these days, there's less flexibility in your interpretation. It's basically, we're seeing what you were writing about. It's not speculative. It's turning out to be, might have been speculative when you painted it, but it's become reality, and that's got to be kind of weird.
It's kind of weird, and is it still motivating to paint? You can't really do speculative art about the present. It's already happened. I mean, right now, I mean, there's a part of me that just wants to go paint still lives of flowers.
Yeah.
Just because, like, you know, and it's, I think it's a natural reaction to like get away from this, because, and other people are doing it. You know, like other, but unfortunately, I'd like to say other people are taking the call and taking, you know, fighting the good fight. Mm-hmm. But the disheartening thing about 2020 is how many people are just asking for authoritarianism.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, they're asking to be spied on. They're asking for, you know, it's weird. You know, I don't want to say it's lowered my thoughts on humanity or, you know, my expectations.
Oh, it has mine.
Yeah, I'd like to
give people the benefit of the doubt, but it's like there's so many people that are doing the exact opposite of what you should be doing in this situation. I feel like, oh, like, come on, people, like, let's get it together. This is the point in time where you're supposed to go, no, we're not allowing more spying on us. We're not giving up more of our rights. But unfortunately, it seems like it's like the Olympics to see who can give up the rights fast enough, like one country versus the other. You know, it's fascinating and terrifying, of course, at the same time.
Well, sure. I used to write about privacy. I called myself a privacy advocate. You know, the Johnny Dollar thing, as your audience may not know, my real name is not Johnny Dollar.
Right.
I sign my real name, my signature on a painting, and then I cover it with masking tape. Call it masking tape encryption. And then I sign Johnny Dollar on there. And the idea is if you really wanted to know my true identity, you could just rip off the tape and, you know, you'd see who I was. It's like a metaphor for, you know, our false sense of privacy. Mm-hmm. That was how I thought it. And I'd kind of been advocating privacy with different reasons for a few years. And then I started with, like, you know, the Cambridge Analytica thing happened with Facebook. Yeah. And I was like, I don't have to do anything anymore. Everyone's going to just quit Facebook because they'll want privacy. It didn't happen. You know, the Cloud Act happened. And that was, you know, where governments could surveil on us overseas. And it was a really big act. I was like, man, people will quit now. But, you know, we'll want surveillance, you know, privacy then. They did. But what shocked me was it wasn't that people just didn't want privacy, didn't care about privacy because it was, they might pretend they care if it's convenient or, you know. But I was shocked at the large number of people that were anti-privacy.
Yeah.
That were, how dare you want privacy? You know, I get it. There's people that like don't like doors shut in their homes. Like you can't shut a door. You know, it's, you know, maybe I'm making that metaphor, but there was a lot of people who were like, how dare you want privacy? You know, I don't want privacy. Why? What are you hiding? You know, And it's, you know, and we already know, like if you got, you know, nothing to hide is very close to nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm trying to be disheartened, but I was like kind of taken back. And I realized that people that want privacy, I'll help. But there's a lot of people that don't want privacy, you know, and I'm not going to, you know, what's that expression, pearls to swine, you know, like only have so much energy. So I have to help the people that want the help.
Yeah.
You know, you can only do so much convincing. I mean, because otherwise most people just want Disneyland. They want a Disneyland full of cameras. And, you know, they want, just cops everywhere, long, but everything's pretty and colorful. You know, like the dystopian movies are always like it's rainy and it's dark and cloudy. But really, your dystopia, your fascist reality has got, you know, is bright and colorful. It's got cool logos and, you know, cartoon characters everywhere and Hello Kitty, you know, and that's like. Yeah, it's Disneyland, you know, like, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and they talk about that in, like, Rules for Radicals and all of these dystopian books, you know, 1984 and Brave New World. They talk about keep it, like, down to a motto, you know, like buzzwords or phrases and things like that you repeat over and over again. And that's all that people really need. You get them attached to that. You talked about people actively being anti-privacy. That's the weirdest thing ever. But I know exactly what you're talking about. There's this misguided belief that they are being they are doing their duty by removing the barriers for the government to come in and do what they need to do to snoop around and see. It's that if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear, that sort of mentality. But we see Janet Napolitano come out and talk about, you know, if you see something, say something, that for the Department of Homeland Security with this whole, campaign that they had out years ago. It's like, oh, yeah, you mean like Julian Assange did or like Chelsea Manning or like, you know what I mean? Like those people saw something, they said something. And what was their reward? They were buried under the prison, you know, so we're being trained to view our anonymity or our freedom as some sort of like, I don't know, add on a la carte feature to our existence that we don't really need. And that if we were really good citizens, we would turn in those excess rights that don't really matter much, because that would show, you know, our loyalty to the government but you and I, and I would presume almost everybody listening to this, we see the world much differently. We are not in a huge hurry to give up our rights because those rights never seem to come back. And when we're talking about something like privacy, man, privacy is a tough one because the removal of privacy turns you into, it turns you into Julian Assange sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy with cameras everywhere, unable to live your life for fear that not just, you know, like the olden days when say like God is watching you, but it literally somebody is watching you. I mean, at least maybe God is or isn't watching you. But in Julian Assange's case, somebody is watching him, watching his every move. And that has a psychological impact on us. So it affects the way we act. It affects the way we talk. It affects what we talk about and what we're able, you know, who we interact with. The removal of privacy is dangerous to a society, is it not?
It isn't, but I would take it to a couple of points. One is there's a whole generation that has no concept of it.
Yeah.
The Gen Z, Zoomers, whatever you want to call them, people under 25, I know a lot of them, they're like, they've been spied upon since they were a child. They had cameras in their cribs. You know, their Nintendo DSs were spying on them in a sense. You know, they never had a concept of privacy. They don't really get it. And it's and they're gone. They're 25 years old. They're grown adults that have been spied their whole life. And that's just they accept that's the way reality is, at least in, you know, the Western world.
Right.
When I say that. But the other thing with privacy that I see, this is, you know, because you mentioned the Julian Assange and a camera over your head and, you know, Big Brother watching or God watching. But to me, privacy isn't about the past or what you did or doing. It's about what you're going to do in the future. Because it's not, you know, the government watching you. It's the algorithm watching you. It's watching everything you do, how you scroll, how long you look at something, not just what you like. You know, it can tell, like, it's watch and it's gathering data where you went, who you were next to, what you were watching, all this data from all these different places. And it's putting it together, and it's just – it's an algorithm, and it's been designed to just predict what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. It says, oh, well, Charlie, you know, and it also knows that when you're emotionally charged, you're more susceptible to programming. So Charlie's agitated in a bad mood or sad. Let's show him a Sarah McLachlan dog commercial. Right. Get him sad. And then let's give him a coupon for Haagen-Dazs right down the street. You know, it could be something like that. Yeah. Or it could be a funnel of, oh, he cares about these issues. Let's put these political ads in front of him. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it can be 20 years from now. It's just adding up who you are. What are the buttons that push that takes to push you? And to me, that's way scarier than, you know, some advertiser, madman from the 50s that's, you know, using Freudian tricks. No, it's an algorithm that's going to your deep brain stem that really doesn't even care. It just wants your attention and figure out what you're going to do and how to keep your attention.
It's devious. I have a marketing degree. You know what I mean? So it's like part of me is like went to school to figure out, you know, and not to say that my life is necessarily going to be in marketing, but it's like, okay, you go in and you're in like the business component and you're like, oh, this is how you sell a brand of toothpaste, this toothpaste versus that toothpaste. You make this one a little bit better, have the packaging look different, you know, the ad speaks to some, you know, psychology aspect of it and all that's fine. And Google comes out, you know, years later after I'm out of school and they put together their platform and next thing you know, their Gmail comes out and it's looking for keywords and it's creating these advertising. And from a purely advertising standpoint, I can appreciate that. I can appreciate that that's kind of what you're trying to do. You're trying to figure out what makes a person tick so that you can show your product in a light that you think might appeal to this person the most. So if it stayed in that world, I could deal with it. It'd just be like to me building a better mousetrap. Like you'd move past the Freudian stuff and the Edward Bernays propaganda, and you'd move into this new level, which is like, hey, we can even use computers. But now it's even beyond that when you've got artificial intelligence, which is just sucking in all of this information, making connections which may or may not actually even exist. It may paint a portrait of you that is wildly inaccurate. It probably is going to paint, you know, as it gets better, a fairly detailed portrait of you, especially if you're on social media like I am, especially if you're, you know, if you're texting and all these things. All that information is going somewhere. It's being stored. And it reminds me of what Edward Snowden says. He said, the problem is you don't have to be doing anything wrong now, but in the future, if you do something wrong, because all this information is kept, it can then go back in time. Whoever needs to can go back and look in time, and they can create the justification for rounding you up and arresting you, or what, where we're moving to now, which is had been theoretical. And Philip K. Dick wrote about it in the Minority Report, and then Steven Spielberg did the movie Minority Report. And we're talking about pre-crime, and artificial intelligence is talking about that. Now I'm starting to see articles on like Activist Post about cities trying to roll out AI pre-crime like now. And I'm thinking, yeah, holy shit, we are on a very slippery slope here. So the idea of privacy, privacy doesn't work in an AI-driven world where it's sucking everything up. I mean, in this, I think we're starting to put the pieces together and say, well, this is part of that smart cities program. And if you get in the smart cities, then you've got everything kind of wired. Everything's wired because it's smart, right? Well, it's smart because it's watching you too. So yeah. You're oh, great. My toaster's going to talk to my refrigerator. My toaster's going to know when I'm out of bread. My refrigerator's going to know when it's out of bread. It's going to automatically order it from Amazon or Whole Foods, whatever. It would be delicious. You know, and all that. You're going, cool, cool. Sounds neat. Until your toaster and your refrigerator conspire against you with your healthcare provider, who's going, you bought too many ding-dongs. Your rates just went up. And it's like, because I know it's in your fridge. And you're like, God damn it. So this is a very dangerous slope.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, where do you see us going with this?
Oh, you know, one thing I'd add is you mentioned marketing and advertisers. The word propaganda is the same word for advertising in Spanish.
Really?
Un propaganda. You know, it's like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, a propagandist, you know, didn't technically used to be a bad word. It just got associated with Goebbels or Himmler. I don't know. I don't remember which ones was the propaganda arm, but of the Nazis. But propaganda simply wasn't a bad word back in the day. It just simply meant advertising or PR. I guess they've changed propaganda departments to PR departments.
Yeah. Like they changed the Department of War into the Department of Defense, playing word games.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, where I see the AI going, and I was playing around with AI art. I have been for about 6 months, 8 months, you know, like I got contacted because I was been on the technology end of the art world. So these people were sending me things. Hey, check out our new AI thing. There's these tools. And a lot of artists are making computer art using AI to create images, using it to create text. Mm-hmm. I mean, I put in images and it created words. I started typing in a story and it started making images based on the words I typed.
Whoa.
And I looked at it. I didn't look at it for like 4 or 5 months. And I came back and it had exponentially gotten better, like incredibly better, to the point of where it was making a real story. Like it could make bios. It could be, I mean, within very short time, a year, 2 years. Yeah, it could make a story. You tell it the archetypes. You plug in all this stuff. It could create writing. I mean, all artists are now, a lot of these artists are curators. They're just like picking and choosing what the AI did and say, oh, I like this. I like this. And you say that's cool. That's like a photographer or a DJ or something.
Right.
But as time goes on, the AI will be its own curator. Okay. It will know, you know what I mean? Like, and, you know, we separate it to marketing, to art, to this. It's all the same to the AI. It's just data.
Yeah.
And like I quickly realized like this AI, it was less a tool for the artist as the artist was a tool for it to feed it data.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, I've the last 6 months to a year. I mean, my whole thoughts on tech have been evolving as it evolves.
Yeah.
Because Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. It's a strange time. Your art, let's pull up some pictures and for people that are listening, we're going to paint the picture with our words, but I'm also, there's a video version of this podcast that is out there. And we're going to see some art, because I'm telling you right now, man, Johnny Dollar's art is so fucking good that you'll look at it and you'll go, oh, I get it right away. I love where you're going with this. So, this is the first one that's up on the screen right now. This is what I was talking about when I asked what do you do? What kind of art? Mickey Mouse holding a lighter, got a can of gasoline next to him with a Bitcoin logo. Explain this. Fill in the details on this painting for people, please.
Well, I usually just say Mickey's broken the shackles of the copyright cartel. And he's used Bitcoin to not only free himself, but to burn down this towering bank of Babel and free us all.
Nice. Who is that in the smoke?
Who do you see?
I see Abraham Lincoln.
That's who I see.
Okay.
I was making another face, but then I saw Abraham Lincoln, and it's appropriate.
It is appropriate. You know? It's amazing. It's like there's a lot going on here. Listen, anytime somebody's burning down the bank, I'm in favor of that. I mean, maybe not literally, but, you know, conceptually burning down the bank. I like that idea. That Bitcoin is the accelerant that gets the fire going, I believe is amazing. There's a lot to read into this, but this is not, there's a political or sociological slant to your artwork. I mean, you're definitely making a statement with it. And I don't know much about art. I don't know too many artists. I do know who Banksy is. I am a fan of the work. If somebody made a comparison between what you're doing and what Banksy's doing, is that a compliment to you? Is that an insult to you? Are you indifferent about that?
It would totally be a compliment. Okay. It'd totally be a compliment. Banksy is different. I mean, Banksy's greatest artwork is his ability to remain anonymous.
I know. Speaking of privacy.
In this modern age, you know, or contemporary age, that's a work of art to stay anonymous. Banksy's, he's one of the greatest artists of this generation for sure. Most influential, at least.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And with his art, much like your art, I take a look at it real quick. And I have an idea of what it's about. I think about it a little bit longer. If I take that image out and I think about it during the course of the day, I find myself going much deeper. Like I get the feeling that like maybe I'm only scratching the surface of what I'm seeing in this. And I guess that's the beauty of art, right? It's in the eye of the beholder, and they can read into it what they will. I know I hear a lot of interviews with like musicians, and people ask them like, "What's that song about?" And they'll say, "I don't want to tell you what that song's about because I don't want to ruin what somebody else might think that song is about, because they're probably wrong, but in their mind, what they see is what they see. And so I don't want to shit on that. So when I see your artwork, I know what I see. I mean, I know where I get my underlying themes of it. But I feel like if you showed this to 100 people, you might get a variety of opinions of what it's showing, what it means to them. And I think that's maybe the power of art.
That's true. That's true. Example. And I would also add that, you know, I don't often describe them also because words are limiting. You know, we don't want to really get into linguistics too much.
Yeah.
But, you know, like your words have different meanings and subcontext for each individual. So things can get lost in words. Yeah. And as a writer, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
for sure.
For sure. Your words can mean different things to different people, or the phrases can be taken out of context. I write about this, as you know, I write about and I've got a new book with Jeff Berwick. So of course we're talking about crypto, we're talking about banking, but this is just like a visual representation of one of the chapters of my book is this picture right here. I mean, it says kind of says it all, you know?
Well, feel free to add it in there. It's all yours.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. The thing I would mention is I was thinking a lot about not only banking, but copyright. You know, copyright is, it's like this unsung chain that's been put around us, especially in the last like 50 years. Copyright, you know, was originally designed to promote, you know, innovation and art, music, patents, and science. And it was, you know, originally I believe it was 25 years, and they did the, you know, the artist life, then the artist life plus so many years. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was 1991, Mickey Mouse, Steamboat Willie was going to come up for the public domain. And Walt Disney had long been dead, the creator.
Yeah.
But the Walt Disney Corporation did not want to lose that intellectual property. Despite the fact that Walt Disney, a lot of his greatest work came from the public domain, like folk tales, like Cinderella, Pinocchio, Snow White. Walt Disney, the artist, used a lot of public domain stuff, you know, our collective culture. But Walt Disney Corporation used Sonny Bono, senator at the time, the Sonny Bono Law, and they changed the law so they could keep their copyright until 2023. I believe it's 2023. It's coming up here soon, and I'm willing to bet they're going to change the law again to extend it, because they're not going to give up their control over our culture. And getting into like culture is a powerful thing. You know, these corporations control our collective. You know, Batman, Superman. These stories are very old. You know, they should be all of ours in the public domain, just as is Sherlock Holmes. Anyone can make a Sherlock Holmes story, you know, and that's only like 20 years older than these other ones. Mm. But it's in the public domain. Anyway, that's my thought on it. I don't want to rattle on too much.
I forgot. You told me that story before, but I forgot about that. But yeah, that's right. That Disney and, you know, Disney. We talk about Disney because Disney's involved in a lot of this stuff. They're not exactly the nicest.
Yeah, no, they're not a nice guy corporation. And, you know, and it's not just Disney. It's patents. You know, they use patents to control technology and suppress technology. These things shouldn't last forever. Right. There's countless stories of really like tech that would really help people, humanity. But, you know, it's stepping on vested interests.
Yeah.
So the vested interests suppress this technology using patent law. All right. Should we switch to another image? Or?
Yeah. I have a friend that works at Disney, and he told me something that was really fascinating a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
He said that they have at Disney Corporation, they have more lawyers than they have animators.
Wow.
Yeah. That should give you an idea of what they're.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. I mean, really, you know, you see, I don't want to spend the whole time talking to how horrible, you know, like dystopia, like I've seen it written with the big D for Disney, mm-hmm. you know, like that's,
yeah. All right.
Shall we do another image?
Let's do another one. Yep.
All right, cool. Let's go with,
And for people that want to go find out what this is all about, you can go to Johnny's website, johnnydollar.biz. It's johnnydollar.biz, johnnydollar.biz. You can check all this stuff out. Okay. This one is my favorite because there's so much, it's so much depth to it. So talk to us about Show Me Your Cookies.
Okay. Show Me Your Cookies. Well, it was inspired by an academic paper called Show Me Your Cookies and I'll Tell You Who You Are. And in that paper, it's an older paper, it's like 2011. These researchers were looking at people's browser cookies. And we know this now, but it was kind of revealing back then. They could tell from a person's browser cookies, you know, their age, their race, their gender, but they could also tell where they worked, or, you know, where they went to school, what they were going to buy in the future. They just gather a lot of information about them. So that inspired this painting, Show Me Your Cookies. So the cookie monster is consuming data. He just can't stop. He's compulsively consuming data. Nom, 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 nom. Mm-hmm. And you can see this girl, she's walking naked through a digital landscape. Mm-hmm. And what you might notice are these birds are following her, tracking her quietly without her knowing it. And those birds form the cookie monster. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the QR codes are scannable. And they lead to a different place online, and they give information. They tell a story, a loose narrative, depending on where you start and where you end. As well as this is also a cryptocurrency wallet. There's some cryptocurrency hidden within the painting because this painting uses not only like the QR codes, but it uses some medieval cryptography, which I guess I can reveal that now if you'd like.
Yeah, just to paint the picture a little bit for the people at home. So it's a vertical painting. The top two thirds has a large blue cookie monster or cookie monster like person, so that you don't get sued. I don't know who's holding up a cookie. And on that cookie, instead of it being chocolate chips, it's like it's kind of a blurred QR code. Beneath this cookie monster is a large. Expanded floor, and a lady without clothes is walking across this expanded floor, but the floor itself is made up of multiple rows of QR codes. You know, the black and white sort of looks like back in the old days, the snow on your television. And so she's walking across this floor that's made of these QR codes, and they're scannable. Of course, you take your phone and hold it up to this, and it's going to take you different places. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, like, you can scan one of these QR codes, and they do take you to different places. A lot of them deal with privacy and different stories about tech. But it also, like I said, contains an Ethereum wallet, which is a cryptocurrency. And it holds a public key. A cryptocurrency wallet has like an address, a public address. And then it has a private key, which is like a password to move the money. And I hid that private key in the cookie that's swirling around and bent. Mm-hmm. It's been solved. So there's people have added more crypto to it, but it's been taken out. But that swirl is a medieval cryptography. If you take a reflective cylinder, a round cylinder, and stick it in the middle of that that curve, its reflection would be a square, mm-hmm. and you can scan that.
That's so crazy. When you explained that to me and showed me that, I mean, look, I'm impressed with anybody that has artistic skills, but this is beyond artistic skills. This is like steganography, like hiding images inside of images and hiding codes. And this is like some, you know, Dan Brown shit. You know what I mean? This is like, you can go on a, this is like a the greatest treasure hunt ever. You know, it's so much thought and like symbolism and layers to this that I saw it. And yes, I had just done DMT like earlier in the day, but my mind was blown. You know, I was like, holy shit, how did somebody come up with this? And what a cool idea. So, I have genuine enthusiasm for this, man, because it's such a, I'm impressed with artists because I don't feel like I either don't have that in me or I haven't developed that skill in me. So when I see somebody that's artistic, it's like magic to me, but to take it the next couple of levels and to have all of this deep symbolism and have it mean so much and talking about cookies and privacy and this whole thing tied back, it's fucking amazing to me.
Thanks, man.
There's no question there. That's just a statement. It's just amazing to me.
Yeah. No, thanks. No, I appreciate it. I really appreciate it. I've got a lot of cool work in mind. But like we talked about earlier, this year's really knocked me for a loop. Because it's like it's like, I don't know how, you know, there's so much going on. Everything's so politically charged right now. So thanks. You know, I enjoy delving into the art and getting a little bit of escape from it. And I think we all need not to fully, you know, distract ourselves, but to kind of step back from it, long view, and try to smile. Because how else are you going to deal with this stuff, you know?
What was the irony of the step back and try to smile about it? And I'm sure that this will probably in some way be incorporated into your work, is the concept of masks and how it hides that smile and how it's a muzzle for us and how it prevents people from seeing the most expressive part of our face or to hear our words and the symbolism of a mask. You know, the idea that you could have a mask for Halloween and it's scary, or you could have a mask for a costume party and it's fun, or you could have a mask that's a symbol of like government overreach and insanity in the form of these masks that we're having to deal with now. I can't even wait to see the, well, and then there you go. All right. So next picture is painting with masks. And I did not know this was coming, but I guess we're on the right track.
So this one, I started this painting probably in 2004. And finished it a couple years ago, last year, actually. It's called The Winter of PC, or, you know, Winter of Political Correctness. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked me, he's like, how'd you know everyone would be wearing masks? And, you know, I think it's a perfect example for the way we live, to where so many of us are just hiding our intentions, the truth. You know, we go outside, you know, I mean, I guess you could say on one level, it's like Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and we're all players, that we have to wear these masks. But now we literally have to wear these masks. And I don't know, Charlie. It's really, like I said, it's on one level, it's like, you know, if you look at this image, I guess we should probably talk about the image itself. All the characters are wearing a mask except one.
Oh, the kid.
The kid. Because they don't wear the masks. At least the masks of pretending they're something they're not.
Right.
You know, and, you know, like you said earlier, I actually, a lot of my these paintings are multi-level. In a sense, you know, there's the dance within the dance, the beat within the drum beat. Mm-hmm. So this has different things. I don't usually talk too much about it, but everything means something. Like in the back left corner, at maybe 10 o'clock, you know, you see the two dogs being held back, the animal instinct within us that's held in reserve. Funny side note of this painting, I painted this painting when I was living in Charlottesville, Virginia, briefly taking some classes at UVA. And that statue in the back, that was the study for that statue was a study, a statue of Robert E. Lee that caused a big ruckus a couple of years ago.
Wow.
In Charlottesville.
That's funny. You had that. That's been in your painting since way before then.
Yes, yes. Well, I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. So these statues have been, you know, you could say at least models for my drawings since I was a kid. You know, there's always the guy and the horse. And that's a whole other subject, you know, the taking down of statues, and they'll be putting up new statues. It's just, yeah, I thought a lot about mythology, cultural mythology, what holds a culture together. And, you know, I've come to realize it's a lot of it is mythology. You know, whenever I've traveled around the world, you probably experience the same. Wherever you go, there's a guy on a horse, whether it be in Europe or South America. In South America, you can't, like a lot of countries, you can't throw a rock without hitting a statue of Simon Bolivar. It's that's a guy on a horse, you know, and everyone says, and you ask, who's that guy? They're like, oh, it's a very great man, you know, and that's how it is. Like, they indoctrinate us with these statues, this culture, this mythology, And I feel like in America, at least, and it's probably happening all over the Western world, they're tearing down our old mythology. Mm-hmm. And I believe that vacuum is going to have to be filled. Yeah. Now, you know, obviously some people are thinking, oh, we're going to fight for the old mythology. You know, that's a whole other conversation. Yeah. But there will be a mythology. Like, you know, a culture has to have something to hold it together. You know, like some belief. Any thoughts on that? I know I'm just kind of rambling on. Well,
I mean, I don't think it's accidental that they do that with, you know, removing statues. That's a very Marxist type thing to do. It's just destroy the history so that people won't remember history, so they won't know what's coming. And usually what's coming is lining up against the wall and getting shot in the back of the head, you know, by somebody because.
On one level. I mean, it's not also Marxist. It's whatever, you know. Yeah. I mean, they tore down Saddam Hussein's statue. The Taliban was blowing up old, you know, those Buddhist, big Buddhas, if I recall. I think it was the Taliban back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, they tear down the idols. You know, that's the thing. These are the idols of the past. And, you know, we live in a culture where we kind of push religion to the side. So our new mythology are, you know, war heroes or cultural figures. But they are the idols.
Yeah.
You know, and you got to tear down the idols when you make a new religion. And I guess Marxism is obviously a religion. You know, I think his name was Antonio Gramsci or whatever. I don't go into your territory. I often muddle names and dates, but they had their guy that envisioned, you know, if you really want Marxism to work, you got to do it through culture, not the economics.
Right.
Yeah, the Frankfurt School, I believe, was all about that. You know, like how can we, you know, do it through institutions, you know, get them through their kids.
Yeah.
You know, that old, you know, stereotype of the 60s professor, some, you know, lady going, we're going to get you through your kids.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know what that meant 20 years ago.
Right.
I get it now too. I mean, a lot of my friends are starting to homeschool.
Yeah, exactly. And because they're seeing what's happening in the university systems and they're saying, I don't know about this, man. These kids don't seem prepared for the real world when they get out of college. They seem the exact opposite, more unprepared than maybe when they first went. And they're coming out with some thoughts that don't exactly – I mean, I'm all for interesting new versions of, you know, how you perceive reality or where you want to take things. I'm open for the conversation, but the what they're proposing doesn't make any sense. And if you challenge them on it, then they have to go to their safe space because you've triggered them. And all that stuff seems to me like this is very unhealthy. And it doesn't seem like it doesn't, if you're going to change the culture and destroy the culture of the United States. And I think a case can be made that some aspects of the culture of the United States, you know, could stand to be updated. That's fine, but what are you going to replace it with? And when you replace it with insanity and when people challenge you on this, then you can't have the argument. You have to like plug your ears and run to your safe space. I just that's a conversation that I just don't know why we're even having, because it's like this seems like you know, lost kids LARPing like they're revolutionaries, but not really changing anything. This pulling down the statues. It's like, okay, I get it. You're mad at history. History's bad. You don't want these people to, you know, you don't want people to remember these bad people that were in charge of slaves and everything. Okay. I can maybe understand all that, but it's like, are we not also then erasing our negative pasts that could serve as a reminder of where we don't want to go? Like, we were this before. Let's keep a statue to it, not because we like it, but because it's a reminder that we're one step away from going back to the time of slavery, you know?
I think that's the point. Is yeah. You want to erase history. You want to like start fresh. If for the revolutionary, you want to be like zero AD.
Right.
This is now the new beginning. And I feel honestly what we're talking about now is like last year's conversation, because this year's conversation isn't about the college kids. It's about the elementary school kids.
Yes.
That, you know, that's what's very troubling.
Yeah.
There's a full on indoctrination. They're using you know, all the addictive tools they have, the colors. You know, I was telling you before we got on the call, I mentioned I was trying to work on a dopamine detox.
Yeah.
But, you know, they use these dopamine triggers to get kids addictive, and they'll make addictive games. You know, these are learning tools, but they're just steady feeding them propaganda.
Yeah.
They're doing it with Netflix. They're doing it with the teachers. And teachers are like on a Zoom call. They're making it like parents can't get involved with young children, like young children. Like there's districts where like, yo, the parents aren't allowed to watch the classroom.
Right.
It's all like they're blending genders. I didn't really want to get into gender because, you know, I know I'm in the art world. I know a lot of people, but there's a lot being done to little children right now to where, you know, they don't need to be worrying about shit like this.
No.
You know, really, they should be reading, writing, and arithmetic, and that's about it. And maybe going outside and exercising.
Yeah.
Because, you know, little pudgy kids need to get some fresh air. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about the dopamine detox. What does that entail?
Okay. Well, I'll tell you how it started. So I've been doing I've been selling NFTs, these digital art online. I had a project a few months ago, and I started selling them on a site called Rarible. It's a very cool site. It's for people that are into crypto, they'll know what I'm talking about. But just to summarize it, I've been selling art online. But not just paintings, digital art, like little drawings that vary in price from like $10 to a few hundred bucks. And I was doing it using Twitter. That's where this market was. And I hadn't really been on Twitter before. Just a little here and there. I started tweeting. And I started getting likes. I was like, oh, this is great. And then I started making sales on Rarible. And yeah, it was nice to get a sale as an artist, you know, get some money. But when you get a sale, there's this flashing red light bolt. Like there's this lightning bolt. And when you get a sale, it's flashing red. That's like, oh, that's nice. I got a sale. Somebody likes me, you know. The next day I sold, you know, a couple dozen pieces of art in a month, you know, or more. It was like a lot. And it was cool. It was like almost every day I'd wake up, I'd turn on the computer, and I get that flashing red bulb. And Charlie, you know, at this point in my career, I'm not that worried about $20, you know, but I really needed that flashing red light, that bolt to, you know, just give me that dopamine rush. Right. And you know, I was using Twitter and I was like, catching myself logging onto Twitter. I don't have it on my phone, so I get it on my laptop. I was logging in like 10 times a day to check how many likes I got. I needed that heart. I needed that red color. I needed that flash. You got that sale. You got that. They really like me. It's like hitting that deep spark part of my brain, the stem. And I needed this constant, you know, electronic addiction. And that's just one level. You know, I was like in bed and I was turning on my laptop to look at Twitter to see if I got any likes or any messages. And I know I'm not the only one that does this, you know, but I
do the same thing. It's like, you know, you post something that you think is super funny or witty or whatever. And you like, if you get the right validation, it's like getting pats on the back. It's stupid, but we're all do it. I mean, it hits.
We do, but it like rewires your brain. Like I was, especially in lockdown, you know, I live alone with my dog, you know, in the studio, you know, I get out, see some people more, you know, but in general, I'm alone or I'm talking to someone online. And online, you know, A, you get the rush of the like, but you also get this instant gratification of you're out of your head. You're going external. Like it was probably a few days ago. I was like, all right, I got to get off the electronics. Let me turn off these distractions, watching YouTube while I work or listening to a podcast and all these things. They're good and all. But I was like too much out of my head, like listening to those things. And like I went to cook some dinner. And I was like, oh, let me just eat it. I had turned off the computer on purpose. But I went to go eat. And I was like automatically turning on the computer to watch a show. Like, I was like, what am I doing? Like it'd been so long that I sat down and chewed and tasted my food. There was no music, no distractions, no nothing. I was just eating like a normal something humans have done for millennia. Just enjoy the taste of food. And it was hard. It was difficult not to have the input to sit down and just read a book, you know, like, and that's the dopamine rush, you know, like you constant, like external stimulation, whether it be a new show, this validation, oh, I'm going to feel good. I'm going to, you know, whether it be validation of, hey, you're a good boy, somebody likes your stuff, or, oh, my friends are on TV on my favorite show. I know I'll enjoy this.
Right.
I don't have to think about the projects, my mom aging, all the, you know, life.
Right.
And that's the dopamine thing. And like I said, it was a constant need of external stimulation. And the computer's the worst because they do it on purpose.
Oh, yeah.
Like for anyone out there, if you're addicted to your phone and you want to make it a little less addictive, you can make it monochrome. Make your phone black and white, grayscale, and it'll cut its addictiveness by factors.
Wow.
I mean, they make it colors. Oh, yeah. They make the sounds when you get a like or something. Bing! And like these pretty sounds and you get a heart. These are things that are colors that they'll get you. No, I mean, I talked to a guy that used to work at Google. He was with their ethics department back in the day. And he was telling me about the algorithm goes for the deep brain stem. He kept using this word, the deep brain stem. I was like, what's he talking about? Yeah. But it's like the reptilian part of your brain deep down in there. And that's what the algorithm's going for.
Okay. We're in trouble.
Oh, dude, it's bad. It's scary. 80% of YouTube views, like watches, are clicks on thumbnails, not searches. And you say, well, okay, whatever, that's you're on there. But like when this guy was talking, it was like a small crowd he was talking to initially. He was like, you ever been on, you just wanted to log into YouTube for, you know, 15 minutes. Next thing you know, 3 hours later, you're watching a Jordan Pearson video going, how did I get here?
Right.
And I was thinking, like, how does he know me? And I'm looking around and everyone's going, yeah. It's the algorithm. It's, and he's like I said, it was 80 some percent of views are clicking on a thumbnail. And I'd catch myself. I was like, I was clicking on the image and then justifying it by reading the title.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's why, pretty girl's face. Oh, pretty, you know, you click, those are the thumbnails that get clicked the most, a person's face. Because, you know, humans, you know, you're a little kid, you see your mom's face when you're a kid. That's the thing we identify with the most. But that being said, like, I cut down my YouTube watching by putting a plug-in that removes thumbnails. If anyone finds themselves binge-watching YouTube, you can just remove the thumbnail. I'll still, like, click on stuff, but I'll read it, decide. It's really wild. Like, little things you can do, and you can kind of hack the computer that's hacking you. You know, it is scary. I mean, it's really humbling. Because, you know, I was always grew up, I got free will. I'm a man. You know, I can think I'm a, no, I'm a, I mean, on one level, I'm just a meat computer that, you know, it's getting programmed. Ding. Oh, I do this. And most of our logic, I think, just justifies our actions. You know, we justify what we did with our logic.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll let you speak.
The first step to acknowledging that, you know, the first step to changing is acknowledging that there's a problem, that maybe we're meat computers that are getting programmed. We don't love to admit that. Not the greatest thing to admit, but if we're going to be honest with ourselves, that's what's happening. We're getting programmed. Okay, we can deal with that. It's not necessarily that we're always being programmed in a bad way. We might just be programmed to want to buy a certain pair of shoes over another pair of shoes. That's whatever. But if we're going to change this, if we're going to make it so that we're not just captured slaves, we're going to have to acknowledge that we definitely have a problem. We have a problem with programs. being programmed. They call it television programming for a reason. We don't even understand, we meaning like most of us common people, don't understand the science behind flicker rates and things like that, and what you see on the television, how it drops your brain into a certain state, which is more susceptible to programming. I remember there's this clip that you can find. It's insane. Remember back when we were kids, at like 3 o'clock in the morning, the television would go off. Like there was no more programming. They would run the America the Beautiful.
National Anthem or something.
And, yeah. And then it would end. Then it would just go to that fuzzy snow. There's a clip of like that America the Beautiful, and they're running the words to it across the bottom. But as the sentence is being sung and changing over to the next sentence, the words are sort of flipping and it's sort of tumbling. And if you watch as it's tumbling, it spells out certain messages like trust the government and don't question authority. I mean, don't question authority. And you can find these. And it's so crazy because it's subliminal messaging, and it's been going on since, you know, back then, which I'm guessing was probably sometime in the 70s, I think. And I've found these, and I was, and you can watch it, and there's like arrows pointing to like people that have dug it all apart. And they're like, you watch it and you're like, oh my God, it's right there. I can totally see it. So we're being programmed. There's no doubt about it. And for us to, I mean, I don't think there's any sort of shame in admitting that. That's what's happening. We just, it's just an acknowledgement of fact.
It's the way we work. And honestly, I think people have been doing it since ancient times.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, the incantations and different forms. Now it's more sophisticated. And I think it's really good if you know your programming and you can program yourself.
Yeah.
You can build your own habits and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can put yourself in trance and self, you know, what, like, you know, people, you know, meditate and mm-hmm. that active meditation, they put themselves in trance or they just hype themselves up before a game. That's right. Programming, you know, like you do a routine or actors do those things before they go on stage right. and they do them over and over and over to get that state. I think that's cool. But when you, it's a kid or when it's an adult and you don't know it.
Yeah.
Like you said, once I realized that I was just clicking on thumbnail. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, I can alter this. Once I realized, yeah, I mean, when you have, like, it's all cutesy sounds, Facebook friends. They chose the word friend on purpose.
Yeah.
They didn't just choose, you know, associate or contact. It's your friend. You know, they chose the heart on Twitter for a reason. They got the cute birds, you know, like, It's all well designed. They have classes on how to make your games more addictive.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, I mean, knowing that it's important. And I believe we can, you know, use it to program ourselves to be the person you want to be. But man, kids, are you kidding me? I mean, hell, adults, are you kidding me? You know, how many of your friends are just like, you know, their political opinions or their philosophies aren't their own. It's just something they saw on TV and, oh, somebody came in with that bad philosophy and the music went wah, wah, wah. Right. You don't want to be like that guy. You want to be.
We're getting programmed when we watch TV and there's laugh tracks. It's telling us what we're supposed to think is funny and what we're not supposed to think. You know, when this is a you know, like you said, that wah, 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 that's like, that's your cue that this person is a knucklehead. And here's the laugh track. And there's the cue that this person was funny. And it's like, are we so dumb that we don't even know the difference? And I guess the answer is there is a percentage of us that, yes, we need to be told what to do. And that's, you know, I mean, that exists. It's, and I don't even really necessarily have a problem with somebody there's trying to tell me what to do. It's the problem is when it's covert, when I'm not supposed to know that I'm being programmed, when I'm supposed to think that I'm having an original thought, but it's not my original thought. It's something that's being pumped into me, or I'm having my emotions manipulated by this or that, or I'm watching the, you know, the beginning of a football game and everyone's doing the, you know, the national anthem. And then the jets fly over, you know, like the big roar and everybody's supposed to get goosebumps and everything. And it's like all that shit. All that symbolism, that's a form of this covert programming. We're getting, you know, filled up with it. And then we don't even, know it. And then we go out and into the world and spread that, our message. And we've been infiltrated by this programming, and it's hard to, but I mean, it's hard to think whether or not we've ever had an original thought, right? Has it come from somewhere, a culture factory or our television or our family or our religion or something. It's like,
I believe Picasso once said, the only thing original is an accident.
That's funny.
In art, like, you know, like, oh, you made an accident. Oh, that's new. And they move on with it. Because otherwise, it's just rehash. You know, how many sitcom stories are there? Like 12?
Yeah,
and they exactly. Just kind of repeat them over and over, you know.
How many medical dramas do we have to see on TV before we're like, okay, enough. Enough of the TV shows of cops, or enough of the TV shows of nurses, or what? I mean, it's like, Jesus, there's like,
and it is propaganda, like journalists. I thought, like, somebody was trying to talk about, you know, journalistic integrity or ethics. I was like, what? That's just some made up shit journalists make.
What's that?
And we see it. The only thing, reason we believe it, is we saw some movies or TV shows. That's not how the world works. I mean, it's not how it's supposed to work. Yeah. You know, it's not just about the truth. It's like, people are people. People have a message, and it's all perspective.
Yep.
And your perception. And that leads us to the next painting. What do you say, Charlie?
Let's see it.
All right. So this painting, let's do, called Faulty Assumptions.
Yeah, this is the one. So we go up and you show me your art book. And you'd show me this picture and you say,
okay,
what do you think?
Okay. Yes. Am I sharing screen yet?
I'm seeing something, but I'm still seeing myself. Yeah. There we go. Now I see it. Okay. So
this painting's called Faulty Assumptions.
Yeah.
And I'm making a digital little microfilm for this. It might be out by the time this podcast is released.
Okay.
So I usually get people to like look at it for 30 seconds or so. I think that's what we did, Charlie. Mm-hmm. And once they think they know what it's about, I reveal. But would you like to describe it for your audience?
Yeah. So the picture is almost the entire. It's a vertical picture. It's a picture of a guy of a painted picture of a man with blonde hair who's wearing a black or blue jeans and like a tannish jacket that's buttoned all the way up. He's got an armband, kind of looks like a Nazi armband, but the swastika has been replaced with Bitcoin logo. He's got his right hand in his jacket pocket, and he's got his left hand sticking straight out, pointing out kind of at a 45 degree angle, kind of like a Sieg Heil thing. This guy looks kind of military, a little bit militaristic, probably because of the armband. Above his head, there is a closed circuit TV camera that's pointing down onto him. And then underneath, you know, and around him, there's paintings that there's three different people's faces. It looks like one of them is Che Guevara, one of them is Madonna. And the third one looks kind of like that kid that got captured in North Korea and killed, but I don't know who he is, but, and then above the mouth of this main character with the blonde hair and the Bitcoin and doing the Sieg Heil is one of those cartoon bubbles, like a white cartoon bubble where text should be, except there's no text there. And I think what you said was, what would you fill the text bubble with, right? Was that the question, kind of?
Yeah. What is he saying?
What's he saying in this picture? And you're like, God damn. You're like, well, there's a surveillance component. There's the Bitcoin, which kind of looks like, you know, kind of looks like the Bitcoin logo, kind of looks like the Nazi armband. He is doing like the, you know, the salute and everything. I'm not sure what to make of of Che Guevara. That could be more like authoritarianism or something. And the Madonna, I don't know. And this third person who I'm not even sure who it is. I'm kind of like, I wasn't really sure what the answer was. I think the answer is maybe even irrelevant. It's the thought exercise of you trying to figure out what somebody is going to be saying. And inevitably you're going to make a faulty assumption, which is the name of the picture.
Yes. Is that one? I don't think that's in the book you have.
It's in the back of it. Yeah, I've got it.
Okay. Okay. Good.
And it shows two pictures. One is with the word bubble covered with white tape, and then the second is when you pull the white tape off, it reveals that there is text underneath the bubble.
Correct. So yes.
There you go.
So we pull off
picture. You're starting to see it be pulled, the tape pulled apart to expose the first letter, which is the letter T, and then you pull the whole thing off, and all he's doing is asking for a taxi.
So he's, yes, hailing a cab.
He's hailing a cab.
So, you know, and I always say, you know, we live in a world of incomplete data, you know, and our minds fill in the blank. And, you know, we have these false assumptions, and we just kind of build our reality based upon them. And we just kind of build upon blanks and blanks. And that's the truth is, you know, all we probably get 1% of all the stimuli, all the information that's coming into us. We can only take and process a small amount, you know, our brains, and we kind of just fill in the blanks. And, you know, without, and it's kind of, actually, I'm trolling people because, you know, I throw those tropes up. There's, you know, the character, there's a woman that's, I merged Madonna and Marilyn Monroe mm-hmm. to kind of do a trope of glamour. It's Che Guevara and Castro merged.
Right.
And on the bottom, it's actually a guy named Vitalik Buterin and Mr. Spock.
Okay. He's the guy that, didn't he start Ethereum?
Correct. Okay. Yes, he did. He started Ethereum. And there's the surveillance camera eye that I kind of put in a lot of paintings.
Yeah.
The thing is about this one that's interesting is there have probably been maybe 100 people have, you know, looked at it and told me what they think it means before I pull off the tape. And I've gotten all kinds of answers. Well, the blonde hair guy is based off a Tintin, mm-hmm. a Belgian comic strip. So a French guy, you know, was like, oh, it's because Tintin's writer was a fascist mm-hmm. back in the 30s. I've had people that, you know, thought that Vitalik was an Auschwitz victim.
Yeah.
I've had people that from Asia that don't get the Nazi thing at all because, you know, they don't grow up with those movies, that culture. Their enemy isn't always the Nazis, as you know, we kind of have or were as I was growing up. That was like the perpetual bad guy in the movie. So it's they don't grow up with that. But the most interesting, you know, is one guy looked at it. He said, oh, yeah, I didn't think it was Nazi. It was the wrong arm for a salute. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't even think of that. You know, so like I said, it's the eye of the beholder. We all live in this. We all create our own realities. And we kind of create our realities based upon those realities.
Yeah.
So that kind of touches on what you were saying earlier.
And we also extrapolate what we think these people are actually saying when maybe they aren't saying anything like that. But in our heads, we're filling in the blanks of this narrative. And in our narrative, that guy is yelling, Sieg Heil. But in reality, he's just calling for a taxi. And that's sort of we're dragging our prejudices and our opinions into this. It's fascinating. I, cause obviously the first time you showed it to me, I did not get that he was going to be saying taxi. And I think that's obviously the point of it, but what is he saying? Well, that's for you to decide based on what you're making an assumption on the way he looks and these people around it. And it's a fascinating, thought exercise for sure.
Yeah, you know, I've had people tell me it's changed the way they look at things. I try to myself, like when somebody's if I see something in the street or somebody aggravates me or something happens, I try to like, you know, it's like the benefit of the doubt. Like, I don't really know what reality is. I'm putting in my own thoughts into this. It's like the story of a guy that's in an emergency room and there's these little kids running around acting crazy. You may have heard this story. And he's like, just getting frustrated and frustrated because he's like hurt waiting to go see the doctor, but these kids are running around and there's the dad's there and he's like not minding the kids. And the guy kind of gets frustrated. He's like, "Those your kids?" The guy's like, "Yeah, I'm sorry. Are they running around?" He's like, "Their mom's sick in the hospital and I haven't been thinking." And, you know, and the guy immediately like reevaluates the situation. You know, he thought the guy was a bad parent. And then he's like, "Oh, he didn't realize you. The kid's mom is sick." All kinds of other things could be going on.
Right.
Is one example, you know. It's just like we don't know what the truth is. And we build upon the truth and we build upon it. And I mean, in the community of, you know, I don't want to say conspiracy theory because that's not the world. You know, a lot of people do that in a sense of they start to like, we don't have all the info, but they have a guess. And then they'll build something upon that guess. Yes. And they'll build a whole Alfred Hitchcock plot.
Yes.
You know, based upon my guess. And in our mind, that frustrates me in like the anarcho-polka world. Because I was like, there's a lot of stuff we have verifiable evidence. Let's kind of go with that and make a change.
I feel, you know, the same way. I mean? Yeah. It's like, well, what is Q writing? What is Q doing? This and that. And it's like, I don't know. I don't know that any of that stuff is even real. I'll tell you what, I don't even need to focus on that because I still have a mountain of stuff that is real that I haven't even gotten through yet. You know, like let's prioritize here.
Yes.
We don't need to invent things because we've got real things happening that we still haven't sorted out. All right, let's see this next one, this Daffy Duck.
Okay. All right.
Because this is a new one. I haven't seen this one before.
Yeah, that's not in that book. It's in the newer one. This is a 2019 painting. This one is called, all right, Donald Goes to the Dark Web.
Oh, oh boy.
So I this is one of my, the way I describe it is Donald, enraged with jealousy, seeing his girl with another, went down to the dark web and using the private cryptocurrency Monero, he bought weaponry to bio-augment himself, to biohack himself, to get weapon augmentation, to get revenge and heal his broken heart.
Wow. So I'll try to paint the picture of this. This is Donald Duck, who is looking at Daffy Duck with Daisy Duck. Looks like Daisy's giving him kind of like a flirty look and Daffy Duck is kind of like, yeah, let's hook this up. He's got, there's like a yellow spiral kind of going behind. It gives it this sort of like drifting into the Twilight Zone feel. And Donald Duck is looking at this. You can tell like he's got like an angered look on his face, but he has bioengineered himself, his arm, his regular arm wing. I don't know what you want to call it. One of them has been replaced by this metallic Terminator style, like metal hand and his foot on the same side. His webbed foot has been replaced by this like spiky Mad Max style, like round steamroller with spikes all over it type of contraption. And he's kind of looking at him like, oh yeah, well, I see you, you know, you two flirting with each other, but now I'm specially, you know, upgraded and I'm going to go do something about it. And then there's the Monero logo down, sort of off to the center.
Yeah.
It's funny because this is pulling in just a whole lot of themes. You've got the dark web, you've got cryptocurrency, Monero specifically, you've got enhancements to your physical body, like artificial enhancements. This goes beyond like, I lost my arm in the war and I'm getting a mechanical arm. This is like getting a mechanical arm so that you can dominate the world type of, looks like that sort of, it doesn't look like it, like Donald Duck lost his arm and his flipper in the war. It looks like he went to Elon Musk's house and got himself, you know, some better armor, some better equipment so that he can go seek revenge. It's really kind of a crazy painting.
Thank you. You do a really good explanation, Charlie. That's good.
I'm trying to paint this picture for everybody listening, because I know that half the people listening right now are at the gym, you know. Okay. They're like, well, they're like, I'll check the video when I get home, but for now they're like, you're gonna have to do this. But I like how you incorporate all the you know, Looney Tunes and Disney World into all of it, because it's, these are images that we grew up with as kids. So we sort of relate to it, and we have this emotional attachment to, you know, we understand what these characters already sound like when they're not even saying anything. We understand what their personalities are kind of like, even though they're not doing anything necessarily in these paintings. So it helps to fill us in on a little of the backstory, but then again, like the painting we just talked about, that could be dangerous too if we're making assumptions about things.
You know, yes. And I mean, on paintings, on one level, I really just want to make aesthetically pleasing, fun things. You know, that's like the number one. And then the bonus is the statements and the things and the questions.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's fun. Like I said, these images are, they're kind of like hieroglyphs for us. I feel like there are shared language, these cartoons, just symbols, things we've, you know, we have around the world, like different symbols that we communicate with, whether that just be like the play button, you know, that arrow, mm-hmm. or, you know, the pause, the two lines, anywhere you go in the world, you know, that symbol.
Yeah.
Same as like the house home symbol.
Right.
Like it doesn't matter what language you speak. We use and emojis, you know, around the world. We're using these, like these hieroglyphs. And I feel like we're entering this level of new communication. Like people speak with memes and GIFs all day long. Like it's accelerating. I don't know if you do it, but I've definitely been in like a forum and seen people have a conversation, just, you know, one GIF after another.
Yeah.
And they don't even have to know the movie or whatever that GIF is referencing. You know, it's like it's a thing in and of itself.
Yeah.
Not just from the movie it came from.
That's a form of art. You know, that's a form of artistic expression. You're conveying a message through an image without saying anything additionally. It's powerful. And if done right, and they of course talk about how, what do they say, the left can't meme, you know, some groups are at a disadvantage when it comes to that. Some have a better handle on how to use visual, an image to paint, to tell a story. That's when you know you've done it right. When you don't even need to say anything, you just show them something and it speaks for you, and everyone goes, I know what that is. Okay, I get it.
No, I've seen. You have to just someone crush a debate with a meme. Like somebody's having heat and they just throw out an image and they're like, boom, destroy the other person.
Yeah.
Cause it has all that other underlying stuff that we carry with us. You know, we're the generation, we're Gen Xers. Yeah. I don't know what they call us, latchkey generation. Yeah, I'd say we're the generation that was babysat by the TV.
Yeah.
You know, like, plop, here you go.
Scooby-Doo and all that.
Scooby-Doo.
After school.
I'll see you in 5 hours, kid. 6 hours. Just right. Watch TV, you know. Like.
But then we take that in and we're now adults and we have a conversation with somebody. And if I say to them, you know, I was going to get away from with it if it wasn't for you meddling kids. Everybody in our generation knows exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about the end of Scooby-Doo when they pull the mask off the person, they expose it. So there is like, that's part of our culture, and that's part of our culture that connects to us. But to kids, you know, the new Gen Z, like you were talking about, they don't see that. They don't have that. They might understand what it means, but they don't have that instant connection to like, oh, I know what you're talking about. I know that feeling of being at home in front of the TV when I'm 8 and the end of Scooby-Doo. And you're like, oh, it was that. It was the Spectre. I should have known it was the Spectre. You know what I mean? You know, and so it conveys this message without words. And that is, that's the beauty of art, huh?
It is. And the art and science is merging. Like we're in a weird era in our civilization. We've kind of hinted on this before. Like, I feel like my art at this point is really about the end of civilization. And I mean it, like, you know, when people say end of civilization, I used to think that meant, oh, we're everything's destroyed.
Right.
But civilizations end all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, or in a cycle, when a civilization ends, that means like feudalism ended. It wasn't like everything destroyed. It just shifted to something else.
Yeah.
Like our civilization is shifting. It's ending. You know, yeah, it's ending. And what's ending, you know, like the crossbow ended medieval civilization, you know, because now any old, if, you know, you probably know this, but like a crossbow, you could train someone to use a crossbow in like 10 minutes.
Right.
You know, you aim, you know, point, shoot. You know, there's a little more to it, but it's not that much.
Right.
Versus a longbow, you need 10 years to become good at that. And, you know, 10 years to become good at a sword,
right,
or a bow and arrow. But a crossbow, you could just hand a peasant a crossbow, they could aim it, and they could take out a knight.
Right.
You know, and a knight was like a tank back in the day. Right. You know, and that changed civilization because the knight could just dominate these peasants. And now all of a sudden, someone could become a force to take out a tank,
mm-hmm,
like that. And that ended the medieval rule. It changed the way things were. It changed the dynamic. It ended feudalism,
yeah,
in its own sense. And I remember hearing the quote that I think was Pope Pius the First or Second said, you know, this, when he saw the crossbow, it would end civilization. I laughed as a kid. I remember seeing it in like high school or something. I was going, oh, thinking that's what we think about nuclear weapons. They're going to end civilization. Nothing to be afraid of. I didn't see it in context. And cryptocurrency is that crossbow, or cryptography, in a sense, is a crossbow in that sense. That we can now, it's a weapon. You know, cryptography was considered a weapons grade material. You couldn't export cryptography to another country for a long time until Bill Clinton signed, I think it was in 91, he signed this act. Or might not, it wasn't 91, it was like 98 or something. But he signed an act where you could do export cryptography. You could do cryptography, which allowed people to use credit cards online to make payments online.
Right.
It was a big deal when he did that, and I didn't realize why. But our entire civilization is based on cryptography, on being able to do a credit card transaction online, or things like that, make purchases. You kind of feel where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
Like cryptography is like the be able to send a message without anyone being able to read it is either going to be unacceptable to the powers that be, or it's going to change our civilization completely.
Yeah.
Because if you and I can send messages and we can't be snooped upon,
mm-hmm,
oh man, that's a game changer. I don't really know where I'm going with this. Like I'm like thinking out loud. I'm riffing.
Yeah.
But
your art has a crypto slant to it. It has a privacy slant to it. And of course those two things go together. And who put the crypto wallet on my phone? You did. You know what I mean? You're
yeah,
like,
yeah,
this is the one you want. We'll do this. So you're teaching me about this. I know very little about the you know, the technical components of it, but I do know about the concept of it, the concept of cryptography and things like my dad, apparently my dad died when I was 16. I didn't have the ability to have these deep conversations about what he did, but when he was younger, he was in the army and he was a crypto analyst. He was working on the Cuban Missile Crisis, apparently. I don't know. I wish I had the ability to get the details of that, but it was back then. And so I understand the importance of that. I understand. I mean, if you study World War II, you know about the Enigma machine and the code breaking, and that can change everything. That can change the balance of power in that war. In fact, I think it did. So,
it won the war.
Yeah.
Cryptography won World War II.
Yeah.
But they can't talk about it. That actually was one, when I learned about that, it was one of the, you know, like the young idealistic patriot, Johnny Dollar, that, you know, put his hand over his heart and said, I pledge allegiance to the flag. You know, slowly, you know, you get, that starts to wear away.
Yeah.
The 2000 election, was like the first bit, you know, college, I was a little woke, but like that really got me when I was like, oh, the Supreme Court decided our president, no runoff election like they do everywhere else in the world and all those things. I started to question, like heavily, heavily question, like my young man beliefs.
Right.
But the World War II one, when I found out we had broke the Enigma, you know, the Nazi code early in the war, very early in the war, but we didn't want them to know that. We kept wanting to get the information theory, you know, we kept wanting to get their information. We didn't want them to know we know their code. So when ships were going out, we'd get code that they were going to get submarined, but we'd still send this ship out and have these sailors die,
yeah,
knowingly, our own troops, because we didn't want to lose the information advantage by knowing we know their code. We were willing to give up those guys to get a bigger fish later. And I mean, that's disheartening. I think a lot of Americans would freak out if they heard that.
Yeah.
You know, it would upset them because they, you know, their dad fought at Guadalcanal.
Right.
You know, where really the guys that won the war were some eggheads in England and in Cambridge University, you know, just kind of looking at code. Yeah. We'd broken the Japanese code really early. Did you know, like, the Battle of Midway was the one that, like, turned the war where Nimitz, like, they didn't want him to do this, by the way, but he got found out the Japanese Navy was going to be right here in the Pacific. So in the fog of night, he brought his fleet and attacked them.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific, like it's a 1 in a billion chance two fleets would meet there accidentally. And he knew it, you know, and the Japanese were ready to surrender after that.
Yeah.
They tried to surrender like 3 times.
Yeah.
But we didn't want to accept it for several reasons.
Yeah.
We wanted a complete, you know, regime change, and we wanted to try out that cool bomb we got.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know it's like a, I feel like a dark chill came over, you know, the conversation, but it's
the power of technology and information in the right hands or the wrong hands and code breaking and things like that. It goes to the core of it. And we talk about privacy in our society and the role of cryptocurrency and it, you know, encryption and things like that. And you start to see the governments coming out and talking against it. They don't want you to have that. They want access to all that stuff. They don't want Bitcoin. They don't want this stuff. They don't want, because they know that that's part of the key to unlocking. If we can make it so that the governments can't corrupt it, then that's their whole racket. You know, their racket is corrupting things. And for them to not be able to corrupt the currency as they have been through the Fed over the last 100 years or so, to corrupt the information that they want put out and to read our personal thoughts. I mean, boy, it's something we need to embrace. We can't give that up ever.
No, data is, we live in that information age. And like, it used to be like land was power, then it was machines were power, then it was money is power. Now data is power because data equals money, data equals control.
Yeah.
You know, Charlie, it's funny, like this last few months, I've really kind of like said, I've probably mentioned that before. A lot of us have like in the course of 2020 have reevaluated things and seen things different. And I don't know if you remember that show Game of Thrones.
Yes.
You know, I've come to realize that our politics, I always knew it, but it's so Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
You know, like a buddy of mine was talking about, and he's kind of on the, you know, I don't want to say he's right or anything like that, but he was like, you know, talking about some emails and Clinton going to jail and things like that and getting all this. I was like, man, that'll never happen. I mean, it's Game of Thrones. Like, doesn't, like, their supporters wouldn't accept that, as these other supporters won't accept this. It's like we're just peons, like you said before. But I was like, in Game of Thrones, I'm not even like a character. Right. They might pass by me. I'm like in like sun on a clay pot or something to some pet, you know, like, you know, we are so below any of these guys. They live in their own world. They're playing their own games. And we're just looking at shadows on the wall. Right. And, you know, like, I'm not cheering for this team or that team. They don't give a shit about me.
No.
You know,
I'm with you. It's been exposed over this last year that it's like, I mean, I hope it's been exposed. I mean, I think a lot of people are waking up to that reality, although we do have an election. So you get polarizing and you get one side versus the other. But there are a lot of people out there that are like, you know, we got to get out and vote. You got to get out and vote. It's like, why? Neither one of these two candidates has earned my vote. How about this? How about I don't have to go out and vote for anyone? How about they give me a compelling reason to actually vote for them? And if they don't, I don't participate in this bullshit. I go to the George Carlin route, which is when people would say to him, you don't vote, so you're in no position to complain. And his response was, oh, no, you've got that exactly backwards. I don't vote, therefore, I have the right to complain. You voted for these fuckers. You're the one that doesn't have a right to complain because you're part of the problem. I'm not. I didn't vote for them. Therefore, I am allowed to complain. And that's where I go to, too, because if somebody – look, if – I voted for Ross Perot, and I voted for Ron Paul. I think I voted for Ron Paul. I either wrote his name in or it was, whatever. But two.
There was one year we could vote for him, and then we'll write him in. Yeah.
Yeah. What?
I voted for Ralph Nader once.
But we're voting for people that we find to be authentic and interesting and really, looking to change things. I don't see that in Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I look at more catfighting and shit like that, but whatever. I mean, that's just
really, I mean, I think now it's like, I'm looking to find the tribe that, you know, you find an anarcho-pulco. It's like, what are we going to do? Like, it's at a point of like, we got to build our own communities.
Yeah.
Cause like, I mean, who am I can't like, there's, I mean, I don't want to say there's civil war or something because I don't see it like that. But there's definitely tension where I live.
Yeah,
and you know, there's little whispers of things, and I don't know. There are guys looking at maps. You know, if you know what I'm saying. And we're a nation that's been at perpetual the forever war. You know, the George Orwellian thing. As long as I've been alive, we've been at war. If you count the war on drugs.
Oh yeah,
and. We've been at war so long, we have millions of people that have combat service in this country. We have tens, if not hundreds of millions of guns in this country. And we have a tense political environment. You know, on one level, if you want law and order, you probably want, you know, no privacy and AI algorithms to watch everybody.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what to root for. For me, I'm starting to look at Costa Rica and go, man, I'd really like to learn to surf.
I know.
You know, like, you know, if I had a family, do I want to raise them in this or would I want to? I don't know. You're a family man, you know.
And where I started that book, where I started writing the Controlled Demolition book, with Jeff Berwick was in Costa Rica. I started it there. That's where I was sitting I was sitting right overlooking the beach, and I started all the framework for how we were going to put that thing together. And I was sitting in Costa Rica thinking, this doesn't suck. You know, this might be a good place. I'm going to write about how it's all coming down. You know, maybe I should just stay here.
I've never been there. It sounds like it's worth a visit.
It's worth a visit. It's a nice place. Hey, where can people find your artwork? Where can they support you? Okay. Where can they buy your stuff?
Okay. They can find my work at johnnydollar.biz or johnnydollar.art, the websites. That's probably the best way. You can find me on Twitter as well at johnnydollarart. That's about it. And they can find links to other things there.
Yeah. Well, you're the best. It's funny that, you know, I mean, whatever, God, universe, however you want to put it. But the fact that we wound up meeting in a DMT session in Acapulco, Mexico, at a conference with a bunch of anarchists and have become friends. And it's just amazing to me and nothing that you could have ever really mapped out or planned out. But sometimes the best things in life happen when you just take your hands off the steering wheel, just see what the fuck is, you know, the universe has in store for you, and you just roll with it. And I feel like that's what we did. And
dude, I applaud that. Yes.
Yeah.
Take your hands off the steering wheel and Let's go. Yeah, dude, it was great. I've enjoyed the conversation. It was really good to chat with you again, Charlie.
Me too. Hey, that's Johnny Dollar. Go support his work. Buy his shit. Share it with everybody. You want to get somebody a cool Christmas gift that they've never had? Get his artwork for them. It'll blow their mind for sure. Thanks, man. Thanks for coming on. And I'll see you at the next Anarchapulco for sure, if not before then.
Definitely. All right. See ya.